Hello, my name is Carolyn Gunn. I'm manager of the Young Lions, and welcome to the New York Public Library. I'm excited to hear a musician, or rock star, as you might want to call him, Ezra Koenig, talk tonight with author John Ray. John's novel, Low Boy, just came out in paperback, and if you haven't read it yet, I strongly encourage you to read it. John and Ezra's conversation tonight will delve into music, words, and the intersections between the two. It ties in with Ezra and his band Vampire Weekend's most recent album, Contra. Please join me in welcoming author John Ray and the man who made us think twice about Oxford commas, Ezra Koenig.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. So we're here to talk about the intersection of music and literature with the umlaut over the U. How should we start? Maybe we could start with a sort of interesting factoid that I read, which is that you took some creative writing classes when you were in college, sort of around the time that the band was kind of being formed or shortly beforehand.
Yes, you did.
I am right.
That's
about
true.
That.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy the creative writing classes that you took? Were they real workshop classes where you sat around with a bunch of other kids and got picked apart, brutalized slowly by the workshop?
No, everybody was really nice. They made sure that everybody was nice. But it was a typical college workshop. I don't know. It was fun. Maybe I learned a little bit. But, yeah, I just wrote some stories. And I guess what you're alluding to is that we took some of the stories and picked them apart to create some of the lyrics, especially for the first album, and even a little bit on the second album. And ultimately, I think the songs ended up better than the stories, but it was kind of good to use the stories as this way to kind of lay down all of these words, and from there kind of hone it into lyrics.
Yeah. And when you say we, was that something that you did collaboratively as a whole band? You would bring in the stories almost the way you would it in a college workshop, and the band would look at the stories and say, oh, I like that line, I like that line. And
well, no, not quite. I mean, some of them, it was just me writing them. Although, yeah, I read most of the lyrics in the band, but there's some notable exceptions where Rostam has written lyrics on our song A-Punk. Chris, our drummer, wrote the part that goes, hey, 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 hey.
Oh, that's it. That's good. Was that based on some undergraduate work of his?
Yeah. As an economics major, he got into that. I mean, yeah. And some people would. That's
an interesting twist on the traditional ho 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 ho.
Yeah, and arguably that's our most important lyric that's ever been written. But no, lyrics, especially a lot of it, you know, it can be like kind of personal. But especially Rostam also being the producer, in addition to also being a songwriter and an instrumentalist in the band, you know, we do talk a lot about the lyrics, and because, at the end of the day, he and I are the ones sitting in front of the computer and spending really long and stressful nights in the studio. So there have been times where he's given me encouragement in terms of how to finish a song, because sometimes, you know, we write a song and we know there are going to be a few verses and one's not done. So I do remember one day when we were working on a song called Blake's Got a New Face, and we had this like last part that we needed to write, and he encouraged me to go just look through the short story project that I'd done in college, and then we got like a little snippet and then we were done. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's certainly collaborative aspects.
Yeah. And were these stories that you were writing as an undergraduate, were they part of an actual potential collection of stories? Were they related to one another? Did you think of them as kind of a whole? Did you ever imagine them as a book? Or?
Well, I guess that's the thing about schoolwork, is that I didn't really have ambitions to be, you know, a fiction writer or to publish a book of short stories, but because I was enjoying taking these classes and because your final project had to be a book of short stories, I just kind of did it. And then it was nice because for the senior honors fiction workshop, which I was lucky enough to be a part of. Yeah, well, that's what it was called. And I don't know how competitive it was, but that's what it was called. I think they gave you like $50 or maybe it was $100 to print up your thing. And you could also use that money for research.
And with that, you bought your first electric guitar. Is that right?
Yeah. And my first lesson, and then that's how I got into music. No, that's not true. I did print up 10 copies of it with a glossy cover at the Village Copier.
Oh, yeah, I've been there.
On Broadway and 112th Street. They're very polite people who work there. But yeah, so
I was just there today, actually.
Really? You're picking up a course reader?
Yeah, no, I was just trying to kind of cruise the undergraduate scene. And, you know.
But, you know, so it was a project, just like when you're in fourth grade and you have to do an art project. And it was good that I had that structure, but I did kind of get the feeling that I was better at, there's something I didn't really grasp about the short story form, and that I was better at writing lyrics.
Mm-hmm. Did you think, even at the time, that it might be raw material for song lyrics?
Well, a little bit. And also, the stories, they tended to be about stuff that I was just interested in at the time, you know, clothes and preppiness and people at college and Cape Cod. And really, you know, that's what the first album is kind of about, so...
Yeah.
And also, it was called Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa. That was the name of the story collection. So then that became one of our songs.
I just want to say that, I mean, it is pretty... I think it's actually pretty unusual. I mean, I'm actually teaching at Columbia right now, which is a funny thing.
Yeah.
That's why I was there, really, just... I had reasons. I had a reason to be in the coffee shop. But it's pretty unusual, I think, for an undergraduate to actually write a series of stories and conceive of them theoretically as a collection. That's rather ambitious. I guess that shows why you were in the honors group then.
Yeah, exactly. You don't play around in the honors fiction workshop. But, well, I guess I keep saying this, but it was also the project. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But I guess also when I get interested in something, that tends to be like what I think about. So it made sense that there'd be, that the stories would be thematically linked. I think it's the same way that we make albums. It's important to us that the albums are thematically linked.
You still think about sequencing and the album as a thing to be listened to from start to finish, rather than, you know, I mean, a lot of people these days just think about, you know, oh, this song will be very downloadable, or, you know.
Downloadable?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, sure. Well, I think a good album is both, you know. I mean, because, you know, we're still a relatively traditional band. We release singles from our albums.
Right, which is cool.
Yeah, I mean, you pick the song that you want to be the emissary for the album. You know, for this album, we picked a song that we made a free download, and that was the first taste. So, yeah, you still have to make sure that the songs can stand on their own, but I do think there's some crossover between the idea of a short story collection and an album.
Yeah.
I think it's important that when you scan an album, you look at the names of the songs and they all go together and they give you like a vibe, you know, a sense of what it's about, and the mm-hmm. same thing with the short story collection. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, you know, I think it's more linked maybe than a novel and an album.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I first... heard the first record, and it really does seem thematic in a way that very few records are these days, you know. And you even have certain places that are referenced, you know, and then kind of mentioned again at a later time, and it's almost the kind of record that one is tempted to think of as telling a larger story. But what's interesting to me, and I was actually a bit surprised when I found out that some of the lyrics came from these short stories, because they're not necessarily... You know, there's a certain kind of pop song that really is narrative, you know, and that really does tell a story. And the songs on Vampire Weekend don't do that, you know. They're more, I mean, the lyrics serve the purpose that lyrics normally serve.
Yeah.
Was it hard? Did you intentionally resist telling stories, like kind of point A to point B to point C stories?
Well, it wasn't intentional, but I guess for the most part, we don't really think about lyrics as being miniature stories. And I mean, certainly there are a lot of great story songs, you know, and folk music, and, you know, I don't know, Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen. Those are like straight up story songs.
Well, a band like maybe The Hold Steady or something is clearly coming out of that tradition, you know, and they have songs
sure.
that tell stories.
And one thing that I like is that people, when they talk about our records, well, some people, they tend to refer to characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they're people in the songs and their names, but still most of the songs aren't really stories in that there's like
right.
a narrative and that somebody starts out somewhere and ends up somewhere else.
Right.
But certainly it's not it's not nonsense either. I mean, I don't know, the word that we've always used a lot in our band is vibe, which is kind of a goofy word and maybe a little new agey, but...
It fits the California theme of the new record.
And fits the California theme, but we were using it even before then. Mm-hmm. And I guess we felt like a song is really just a vibe. And I mean, already music inspires emotions without... while being a completely abstract form. So it kind of made sense that the lyrics would reference a time and a place and people, but still be a little bit more of just, more of a vibe than a specific story.
Another interesting aspect of that that just occurred to me is that the way, you know, that first record was received, people made the mistake, I think, of not thinking of the various sort of people alluded to or described in the songs as characters. They did that thing that fiction writers often have to deal with, of, you know, readers and also sometimes even critics just drawing a kind of direct correspondence between what you write about and your own life. You know, I think there were assumptions made about you guys that, oh yeah, you know, they're writing a song about Cape Cod, so they must all have like some sort of like mansion and houseboats in Cape Cod and just spend all their time playing croquet or something like that. When in fact, these were characters that you guys were making up.
Well, I know, but that is true about us.
Yes, you're...
Now,
I've been to your compound. I know. Yes. I've played shuffleboard with you guys, but...
Yeah, I kicked your ass in tennis.
You did, yeah.
No.
That's not hard to do.
No, but... I guess... That is always a little interesting. And I guess the thing is that I've always felt like none of our songs are ever fantasy. And they are based in real experiences, but sometimes you have experiences with people and you write songs about them and maybe even the songs from their perspective. But you're not always, as a songwriter, you're not always given the same kind of leeway that maybe a novelist would get. That, you know, that like something of a detachment, or I guess you run into the same problem.
No, it's very funny. If you write a novel with an alcoholic in it, then people will come and like gently take your elbow after reading and sympathize with your problem, and like hoping that, you know, suggest like a good like AA group to join and stuff. It's really funny.
No,
people often ask me whether my mom was upset because the mother in my most recent novel is schizophrenic and is troubled. And I just tell him, no, my mom never even thought that could possibly be her because that character is blonde and my mom's a brunette. You know?
There you go.
But it's really true. My mom was like, I'm not blonde.
Yeah.
So I wish I could say that when people think that, like, you know, a novel is like a weird indirect self-portrait or something. I wish I could just say, well, I'm not, obviously not blonde. So, but have you found yourself kind of put in that position of trying to like remind people that just because you choose to, you know, write a given song about a certain lifestyle, that's not necessarily exactly where you come from?
Oh yeah, no, many times. I mean, it certainly had plenty of interviewers who would, you know, they were sympathetic to the band or they were fans of the band, but still the reason that they liked the band is because they felt and I had somebody, you know, say that, you know, when you wrote these songs, it really felt like you were taking a good hard look in the mirror at where you grew up and your own privilege, and that you were, you know, dissecting that. And like, I salute you for that, because like more filthy rich kids should be doing such things. And I was feeling, whoa, okay, hold on, you know, he wasn't giving me any credit for having any characters or any detachment. But sometimes the truth is that you could be interested in a subject, and the subject, people assume, has to kind of be intrinsically related to your own life. And also at the same time, I mean, I think most people, quite a few people in America, or, you know, or people who go to a college that has people from all over the place, tend to meet lots of different people.
Yeah.
And those people do affect your experience. And, you know, I have been to Cape Cod before.
You're saying that for the record?
I'm saying for the record. I have been to Cape Cod. Well, when I was a kid, I think I went maybe 3 times with my mom.
Because I heard you went 4 times, but that's cool.
Okay, well, it's going to be 4 times, maybe. But I went with my mom and my sister and my dad. My dad couldn't come because he couldn't get off work. But so we went with my mom and my sister, and we had some friends who were there. So we spent some time there. And I remembered it because it seemed like a very different place for me. You know, I grew up in northern New Jersey. But when the album first, well, actually before the album came out, I played it for my parents, and, you know, my mom thought it was, like, funny and goofy that there were all these songs about Cape Cod. And my dad literally said to my mom, "What's he going on about Cape Cod about all the time?" Because he forgot that me and my mom, that my mom, my sister, and I went to Cape Cod.
Let's be correct. Here we are in the library.
No, I want to keep it right. And I mean, and that's the thing. You can go to Cape Cod. It can impact your memories, especially your vibe memories.
Yeah.
But it
my
can be,
vibe was definitely affected. Yeah, by my visit to Cape Cod.
But it can be such a small part of say your family's identity that your dad is confused when your debut album comes out.
Right.
And I think obviously
you choose to, in the same way that a novelist would, you choose to write about Cape Cod because Cape Cod has a certain set of associations in people's minds. And you can use the place Cape Cod, and it's going to set off certain associative responses in your listeners that you know, choosing a place no one has ever heard of would not
do. Sure. And I realized recently is that I've been to Cape Cod. It was a part of my life, but I realized I spent probably an equal amount of time down the Jersey Shore because one of my best friend's family ran a small motel in Wildwood, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I only realized that recently from becoming obsessed with the Jersey Shore show on MTV.
I was
going
to say, that's when you were running with the situation.
Exactly. But Wildwood has a lot in common with Seaside, where that show is filmed. And then I kind of realized that for whatever reason, at that time in my life, maybe because I had just graduated from a school like Columbia, which is an interesting mix of things, and certainly has its Ivy League snobbery and its out-of-touch rich people, like a lot of colleges. Maybe that's why I was thinking more about Cape Cod at the time, but maybe just as easily the first album could have been all about the Jersey Shore, and I don't know. Maybe the next album will be, but it's interesting.
It is, you know. It's interesting because, in a strange way, and I don't think this says very good things about rock critics and the blogosphere, but if it had been all about the Jersey Shore, there would have been a distinctly, not a completely different reaction, but it would have been distinctly different.
Yeah. And I think that I think a lot of people have that choice. Well, that's why you can't be purely defined by any one set of associations. And of course, when you release an album and people start writing about you, you know, they reduce you to a stereotype. And, you know, it's true that we were all into this, certain types of shirts, certain types of shoes, and talking about certain places. So, you know, fair enough, certain critics reduced us to this kind of rich kid stereotype. But I think most people's experiences, even the actual, you know, filthy rich kids, is still more nuanced than that. You know? I don't think you can reduce anybody to that.
Well, I find it interesting that people didn't consider that it might be actually a very conscious decision that you guys had made to, you know, represent yourselves a certain way, and that there was a certain tongue-in-cheekness about it and a certain self-awareness about it, you know? I mean, it would be kind of like people, I don't know, like actually believing that the Strokes were a bunch of, like, kids who'd grown up, like, down the street from the Ramones or something, you know? It's sort of like, okay, these kids, the Strokes, oh, they're wearing, like, ripped jeans and they dress like the Ramones, so they must have the background that the Ramones had growing up.
Well, I don't think most people know what the Ramones' background was.
Yeah.
To be fair,
they actually went to Columbia. I think they did honors creative writing.
They may have. Well, I mean, I guess I don't really know either. Maybe, but I thought, you know, I think Joey Ramone was a skinny Jewish kid from Forest Hills, which is very different.
Yeah,
very different from. Especially like when you're in a band and you go do press and other places, people really fetishize New York, as they should. You know, but it gets to the point where
I'm fetishizing New York right now.
Yeah, we all are by doing this. But yeah, so people are really obsessed with placing your band in the lineage of the Strokes and the Ramones. But of course, like when you're talking to a journalist from, I don't know, Germany or Holland or something, you know, they probably don't have the full range of references to, like, really understand, like, what Forest Hills is like. You know, just like, I don't know, the Forest Hills of Amsterdam, I don't know about. But, you know, and so they're allowed to reduce the Ramones to, like, a series of cliches and kind of overlook maybe certain elements of their sense of humor.
Right.
Maybe to them why it was a little funny to you know, dress up in leather jackets or something. I don't know.
Right.
But, and then, so the question we get a lot is, it's, you know, so, like, now you're a band from New York. Are you, like, really trying to, like, change, are you really trying to, you know, change the people's perception of what New York means because you guys are clean, your guitar tone is clean, your faces are clean, your shirts are clean. Are you trying to, like, say that, has New York changed? Are you trying to be the embodiment of it? And then when you really look at all the other bands they're talking about, it's not quite as clear-cut as that.
Is that mostly European journalists who ask you those questions?
It's mostly
questions?
Dutch journalists, is the truth. Yeah.
It's kind of scary when you go to Europe and, like, people really, like, they've just analyzed the fuck out, excuse me, the fudge out of your stuff, you know? And they've taken it to this, it's this certain aspect of the European mindset, especially in Germany, I find, you know? I got a book that came out in Germany, and the head of the publishing house was sent me an email, and he's like, I just want to say, you know, I really appreciate how tightly constructed your novel is, and there are all these doublings, and, like, there are all these kind of, everything is mirrored in this other way, and I think it's really interesting how the detective character's name is Latif, but if you spell Latif backwards, and my English isn't so good, but if you spell Latif backwards, it spells fetal. Mm. And I was just, like, reading this, I was like, but he was the head of my publishing house, so I just wrote him back saying, oh, I've been waiting for years for such a close reader.
Yeah. But, I mean, we probably do the same thing.
Yeah.
Maybe not. But, well, I thought about
it. I hope not for your sake, but...
Well, no, I mean, a little bit.
Yeah. It's not
different. I really liked, like, have you ever listened to the Village Green Preservation Society, the King's album?
I have. I'm acquainted with that record, yes.
So I was very obsessed with that album. And to me, I think especially, you know, being 13 or 14, that in a big way, that probably defined my idea of...
You were 14 when it came out, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Me too.
The late 60s, it was a heady time for an American teenager.
It was. I don't regret any of it.
You know, so that you know, to me, that was like, I was totally like an Anglophile, and I, you know, and I really fetishized all the stuff that he was talking about. But I started to realize that, you know, the Kinks, that, like, or the Davies Bros, they grew up in, you know, North London, mm-hmm. and, you know, there are all sorts of subtleties about the fact that they were talking about kind of like this old English kind of rural lifestyle in those songs. That, of course, to me, I couldn't pick up on at all. You know, to me, the songs were just straight up like a description of Britishness, as opposed to me realizing that there's a lot more going on as I've gotten older and spent more time there.
I think it's really interesting because I think in England there's a whole different set of rules that apply, you know, in part because England is an island and they've always been very acquisitive and kind of absorbed outside influences. But, you know, I don't think many people in the UK gave, you know, the Animals or the Rolling Stones a lot of shit for wanting to play blues, you know. I think that was more in the United States. And it's interesting to me, I'd be interested to know, but, you know, the United States is in many ways a kind of oddly anti-intellectual place. And it's a kind of place where people don't even really want to admit to having, you know, gone to college or to grad school, and particularly not if they're artists. You know, there's this idea that, you know, an artist has to kind of invent him or herself out of nothing or out of some kind of hardscrabble background.
Yeah.
And is this whole thing that, like, some people have gotten all up in a dander about, the fact that you guys are kind of unapologetically college educated and you're not pretending, you're not wearing, like, the dirty jeans and pretending that, like, you know, your mom was like a stripper or something.
Well,
is it? Yeah. I mean, I'm not assuming.
Okay.
I'm not making any assumptions.
Yeah.
I don't. You know. I mean, more power to Ms. Koenig if that's what she did.
Ms. Bass.
Oh, I see. That actually does kind of sound kind of racy.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Anyway, my question is, I'm sorry.
No.
I will get to the question now. In England, were you guys given shit for being, you know, kind of deciding to reference this sort of preppy aesthetic and all of that to the same degree that you were here?
Well, I think we were given more shit in America because it's always easier to shit on people that you think you understand. Whereas I felt like in England, people would at least cut us some slack and be like, well, whatever they are, they're American, and, you know, we can't fully understand it. But one of the first headlines about Vampire Weekend in the NME, which is, you know, at this point, the only weekly British music magazine, was somebody came and reviewed one of our shows in New York, and the headline was, "Pashos Make World Music, Ace." With an exclamation point. So they called us Pashos, which, you know.
I have no idea what that means.
It means you're posh.
Oh.
That's a
kind way of saying it, isn't it?
Kind of.
I don't know. It's sort of like shagging. I don't know. In England, that's apparently a really dirty word. If you're walking down the street and someone calls you a Pasho, are you supposed to get upset or are you supposed to be like, damn right I am?
Well, it depends if you're a Pasho, I guess. But, so yeah, I mean, like, people would make references to it like that, but, I feel like in America, and especially what you were talking about before, the anti-intellectualism, I think that's definitely true. And I think kind of that weird kind of, like, self-creation myth that all artists have to kind of come from some sort of difficulty, and not just any type of difficulty, a very specific type of difficulty, creates this kind of self-hatred. Even among people who went to college.
Definitely.
And one thing that I certainly learned from this entire process was that people immediately associate college in America with money. And very few people would take a step back and say, like, well, that's a problem. Or if a college is so associated with money, then that's the real problem.
Well, it's very odd because we now live in a country in which virtually everyone goes to college of some kind.
Well, I don't know the statistics on it, but...
Well, I mean, certainly compared to 50
years more,
ago.
No, that's certainly true, is that more people do go to college. But also, I would assume that the majority of people who go to college in America take out some sort of loan or receive some sort of scholarship, do not pay for it straight up. You think that's true?
Well, certainly a very significant percentage.
Yeah.
I don't have the statistics.
And yet, despite that fact, well, and despite the fact that that the loans are so out of control that, like, you know, there's congressional hearings about it, despite that fact, still the fact that you would say that you went to Columbia for a lot of people still means, like, okay, college boy, you know, okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Richie Rich. And
definitely.
Certainly, my understanding is that, you know, 100 years ago, that was 100% the case.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know the statistics, but you would hope that as a country we'd be moving towards a place where you would say you went to college, and it wouldn't immediately mean that you came from some sort of silver spoon privileged background, you know, because that really sucks if that's become the case.
Right.
And certainly I feel like that wasn't the case for me or for the rest of the band, but it's interesting to see how angry people still get about it. You know, it's not just about the money, it's about the education. Even people who went to college can feel very angry about it. And, you know, like, if that's the problem, then that's something that maybe everybody should be addressing together. But to start to get angry at education clearly is not the way to deal with a problem.
Yeah, I think we're probably all in agreement about that.
Maybe. I don't know.
But, you know, it's interesting because I've lived in New York for a long time, and I've come to know quite a few musicians, and I actually know a couple people who dropped out of high school. And the strange flip side of that is that, you know, one of my first friends in New York was Sean Marshall, who's in Cat Power.
Sure.
And Sean dropped out of high school, and it continues to trouble her. You know, it's you're kind of caught in this bind, you know. If you don't get a good education, we live in a society in which you're kind of always made to feel a little substandard for that. But if you do, you know, if you did just kind of get the education that any reasonable person would try to get if they could, somehow that there's a temptation to consider that suspect in an artist, you know? And it's true in writers also, you know? I know a bunch of writers who won't mention the fact they went to a writing workshop or went to graduate school in writing, yeah. And those who do are always very kind of apologetic about it, or they qualify it this way or that, as though going to school for anything creative somehow devalues it. It's a strange thing. It's like a strange paradox. Let's all mull that over for a second collectively.
Yeah.
You know, when I was saying I didn't have the statistics for a while, you guys maybe can't see, but there's a gentleman in this room up there. It's sort of this illuminated window. And is that the sound guy?
I don't know. I think he might be on the phone.
He almost looks like a telemarketer. And I feel as though he might have the statistics about financial aid.
He might have the statistics.
I don't think he has any idea that we're talking about him.
No, no. I think that just might be his office. It's a late night at the office up there. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway,
yeah.
Moving on. It's funny. It's somewhere also, you've mentioned Haruki Murakami at times as some kind of inspiration for the new record, Contra.
Did I?
Do you like how I just plugged your record to the crowd?
Yeah, thanks. Out now.
And I'm trying to remember where I read that. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, actually. Did you guys have a profile in the Wall Street Journal?
I think we did an interview with the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah. And you'd mentioned Haruki Murakami, I think, and how the Wind Up Bird Chronicle in particular was some kind of oblique influence on...
Yeah.
Is that totally out of left field, or does that make sense?
No, that makes sense.
I thought that was interesting because he, of you know, among contemporary novelists, he's very overt and upfront about the influence that music and, you know, a lot of it jazz and classical, but also a lot of it contemporary sort of pop and indie pop has on him as a writer. I interviewed him once, and one of the moments in this interview, he's sort of a poker-faced guy. He's very kind of like a Japanese man, you know?
Yeah.
He's very intense but sort of stern. And one of the few times that he really kind of cracked this smile and started kind of giggling like a junior high schooler was when he told me that he was thanked in Radiohead's liner notes for Kid A.
Is he?
Yeah. In the Japanese pressing, apparently.
Wow.
Shameless pandering on the part of Radiohead to the Japanese market,
yeah.
Maybe.
That's a great rock trivia fact.
He was psyched about it, yeah.
I'd be psyched, too.
Well, yeah. So, but it's funny that I mean, do you think that... Was that a... I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just has to do with proximity to pop culture or something. I mean...
Well, I think that's true. I mean, he talks about specific stuff, which, you know, seems like that's what everybody does, but not everybody does it. I mean, to talk about specific records, sometimes people find... Like,
well,
there's something wrong with it.
That's a big no-no. I mean, if Haruki had passed through the American creative writing workshop gauntlet, that would have been... I mean, he does a bunch of things you're not supposed to do.
Yeah. One, I think it can be a treacherous line, and especially in rock lyrics, too, or lyrics in general, to talk about specific stuff.
Yeah.
Either people will think you're just like a total cornball, or that you're somehow stupider than everybody else. Well, either stupider or trying to be smarter than everybody else.
You mean to make reference to, when you say specific things, you mean specific other artists? Or?
Well, to name drop, to talk about specific brands of things, to talk about people's names. It almost seems like to some people, the ideal kind of lyrics, you know, straight up are just talking about like love and death in these kind of general, vague... poetic ways, but which has always seemed to me to be talking about nothing.
Right.
But then occasionally, you know, people accuse us of talking about nothing. But I always feel like we're talking about extremely specific things. It's the opposite of nothing.
Well, that's a very writerly impulse, actually. I mean, that's something that is a very important thing in most fiction to keep in mind is to make sure you ground things in specifics. You know, that the sort of if you become too generalized or abstract, you might as well be writing philosophy. You're not really...
Well, when I start out writing some lyrics and I go into it saying that I want it to be about loss or love or coping with, you know, death or something, that always turns out like the worst shit because you can't... Those are such important things, but it's just very hard to start that way. And I think, you know, that's why I've always been a huge rap fan, because in rap, that's what it means to be a good rapper, is to be specific and to have specific references and to be funny and to be topical.
Yeah.
As opposed to this other kind of weird ideal that I don't think anybody actually likes, which is to be, like, deep, to be abstractly deep.
Right, you know? Yeah, deep philosophical hip-hop is not necessarily... It can be. It can be deep and philosophical, but usually the way... I mean, it's actually interesting. Like, really good rappers have, like, a very good writerly instinct in which they do. They kind of lead you into surprisingly profound territory, but through, like, this sort of breadcrumb trail of specifics.
Yeah. And I think that to write... I mean, to me, that's, like, the most... Even though at this point it's pushing 40, or at least 30, that rap is still, like, the most modern type of pop lyrics. And I would hope, even in just a small way, that the lyrics in our band are somehow related to that. Because if you look... I mean, if you actually want to call pop lyrics an art form... And you look at, and you know, something that's maybe existed for 50 years or maybe going back, you know, 100 years if you want to be, like, really broad about it.
Sure.
To me, probably, like, the only major turning point would be, you know, like Rapper's Delight. To me, that's, like, a time when things really changed, you know. And I'm not talking about, like, musically. You could talk about that forever. Musically, how things changed.
But I mean,
just
Sugar
lyrically.
Hill Gang, musically, maybe not so much as lyrically, right?
Well, yeah, in terms of what we're talking about, I mean, because to me, that's the first song. I mean, you could talk about some weird 60s Bob Dylan, like, what's it about? But to me, it's a much more interesting question is to ask, what is Rapper's Delight about?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I've thought about probably, you know, since I was 12.
Right.
What is Rapper's Delight about? And what's so interesting about it is
maybe
like,
about how the Sugar Hill Gang are like, really badass and, like, good people to have at your party?
Well, kind of. Well, it's partially about rapping, which has always been, like, endlessly fascinating, that that you could rap about being good at rapping, or that you could write, or, you know, in our case, that you could write lyrics about being good at writing lyrics. but also the fact that Rapper's Delight, it's about, well, there's the nonsensical part. It's about the sound of words, the hip-hop, the hip to the hippie.
Right.
It's about sex.
Right.
Being a Superman lover in one verse. And then there's also the verse about, did you ever go over to a friend's house to eat and the food just ain't no good? Because the macaroni's soggy, the peas are wet, and the chicken tastes like wood. And the fact that those are all in the same song.
I have actually had that experience, yeah.
Eddie, you went to a friend's
house. Haven't we all?
Yeah, we've all been to a friend's house where that happened. And the fact that it's one song, okay, obviously it's different dudes, but it's one gang. It's one song.
It is one gang.
It's one
gang called Sugar Hill.
And really, it's a song that's kind of just about lyrics. It's about words. It's about a lot of different things. And yet it's still, you know, to a lot of people, one of the greatest songs of all time. And to me, that's like a fundamentally different way of thinking about lyrics than what came before.
That's the excitement, I think, of early hip-hop, too, is that it was this time when you really have the feeling that for them, just anything goes, you know? Like, anything you want to throw in, as long as it has a kind of... You know, as long as it works within the context of the song. Later, rap became so, you know, now it's better, I think, again. But there was a period of time, particularly when gangster rap was so dominant, when there were certain things you just wouldn't really rap about because it just was somehow not appropriate to the type of thing you were doing, you know. But there was this time with, like, Sugar Hill Gang and even all the way up through, like, Biz Markie, where you felt like, they would just rap about anything that came into their heads, you know? And it must have been a very exciting, liberating time for them.
Yeah. Well, I think there's always somebody who's doing that. And whether it's in... And obviously, you know, it's the history of rap lyrics is not some sort of, like, monolithic thing. And,
right.
And hopefully there has been, like, some crossover here and there. Yeah. I have, you know, one band that I was in high school, I rapped in. I was a rapper.
You were?
Yeah. And in college, too, I had a rap group.
Uh-huh. What was your... Did you have a pseudonym then?
I never came up with a really good one. The closest I came to having a rap name was Ezra Factory, which I realize is totally weak.
As in a factory that produces Ezra.
Well, I thought you could look at it in a few different ways. Yeah. That a factory that produces Ezra... Because my shit is so hot. Also, a factory that I am a factory.
Right.
A creativity factory.
The factory named Ezra. Yeah.
And then I also
like the factory of dope rhymes.
Yeah. And I like the also the reference to Factory Records, which is of course a very cool record label in the history of rock. But and, okay, I was better at the lyrics than at writing a name, at coming up with a name.
I mean, it's actually sort of like an uncommonly humble rap name in a sense.
Yeah, well, were you perhaps too humble for the
whole hip hop game?
No. I mean, I could brag a little bit on occasion, but I think honestly that studying, I still to this day get the most inspiration from rap lyrics. I think even though whatever rappers like came out 32 years ago.
You're making me feel very close to death right now.
Maybe the guy up there can do a number crunch for us. But even though that song came out such a long time ago, it still is, it's weird. There's still this kind of pressure outside of rap music to write lyrics that are about the big one topic. It was love. Or you could say there's about being happy and love and being sad and love, two topics. And that you have to kind of approach it in kind of a philosophical way. And yet, you're right, there is kind of an anything goes feeling in rap, as long as there's kind of an embrace of the sound of words.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's something that doesn't only have to exist in rap, and I think there has been plenty of crossover in some ways between the two. But when you talk, but people rarely talk about kind of like lyrical crossover, because it's a lot easier to hear musical crossover, you know?
Yeah. Do you sometimes feel that not enough attention is paid to lyrics in general in record reviews? Do you feel that way with actually, it's interesting now that I asked that question. I feel as though people have paid closer attention to the lyrics of Empire Weekend than they do with most bands.
Yeah, well, it gets back to that whole identity thing. That in a lot of the reviews of our band, when people talk about the lyrics, it's, well, at its worst, it's some kind of amateur psychology stuff, talking about how, you know, good or bad, how I am wrestling with these issues in my life, and people use the lyrics to kind of just as if they were reviewing, I don't know, a speech that you gave,
or a transcript of a therapy session,
or a transcript of a therapy session, but. I definitely, sometimes people pay too much attention to the lyrics. I would never complain about the amount of attention paid to our lyrics at all. In fact, I would say that I think it's kind of lucky that rock or pop lyrics are still one of the most widely discussed forms of weird poetry out there.
Yeah.
I mean, there are like websites where people talk about what lyrics mean. We have fans of the band who I don't think, who seem not to be, you know, deeply interested in you know, modern poetry, but who are really interested in what specific phrases mean. And it's really exciting that we get to kind of work in a medium where people still really care about words, even words that don't tell a story.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is kind of rare. So it's cool that that's still the case.
Yeah. Know? Yeah, I think that's very true. I mean, I actually, one point, for no good reason, maybe it had something to do with something I was working on, but I decided to visit all the different blogs and like sites that are devoted to analyzing Bob Dylan's lyrics.
Yeah.
And it's maybe frightening, I don't know, or just really impressive. Like, there are people who essentially, their full-time job is analyzing and reanalyzing Bob Dylan's lyrics, you know? And there are sites like this for, I mean, much more contemporary musicians too, but
Rap Exegesis.
Yeah, yeah.
Although absolutely. They changed the name to Rap Genius,
right? Not as good.
I don't know why. I think there's some religious people were angry. That was a website called Rap Exegesis.
Yeah,
but pay really close attention to that.
Yeah, well, you did a little exegesis of Rapper's Delight. I actually had this
little
fantasy thing that we would just keep going, and that would be the rest of the evening. The rest of the talk would
all
just
of rappers
be Rapper's Delight.
Yeah.
It's a very long song. You could do it.
But, I mean, I've certainly... It's that last kind of, like, really esoteric kind of text that I think a large group of people still pore over, and that's music lyrics.
Yeah.
We, and, you know, I mean, obviously people do that with the Bible, too. It's the Bible and music lyrics.
This is the point where you say, because really, Vampire Weekend is more popular than Christ.
Yeah. I'm not going to say that.
Yeah, but it didn't work so well for John Lennon.
No, but you should have met this woman that I sat next to on the plane last week. Let's not talk about it.
Let's talk about it.
It was wild.
No?
I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say about it. It was a really wild 2-hour discussion.
She was an intense Vampire Weekend fan?
No. I don't want to talk about it. But I don't know. I think it's cool that there are people who would care about the weird things that happen in a Bob Dylan lyric or in a Lil Wayne lyric, that people would actually care about it and spend the time kind of like digging through the references and seeing what they mean. And obviously, to a lesser extent, some people do that with Vampire Weekend lyrics, and I think, you know, that's like hugely thrilling because you can enjoy an album without caring at all about the lyrics.
Yeah, there are a lot of people.
And some
do.
People, and yeah, most people do, maybe. But it is cool that there are people who are willing to pore over the text of a song, you know, and you know, look for the meaning. I mean, you know, I was like an English major in college, and you're always kind of made to feel like what you're doing in college is the last time you're really going to do that, and the last time that it's going to matter, or that you're going to be sitting in a circle with people who care about doing close readings of something. I mean, obviously you're a novelist, so you still probably hang out with people who write stuff. But you know, there's kind of that feeling that you're an English major, and this is the last time that you're really gonna get to seriously think about the meaning, about words, and you know, pore over stuff like that. But it's cool to think that pop music, which is still such a huge part of pretty much everybody's lives, that still happens to. And I mean, and it's not just the kind of weirdo dudes like Bob Dylan and Lil Wayne.
Right.
People do that with Taylor Swift and the Jonas Brothers, and I mean, what more could you ask for?
Yeah.
You know, people, teenagers all around the world are doing close readings of texts.
Yeah.
Straight up. And you know, where else is that happening?
Right. Now, when you first started out, though, you probably didn't ever think that anyone was going to pay that close attention to your lyrics. But now, of course, your first record came out, it did really well. When you got around to writing the lyrics for the second record, you probably did have a sense that people are going to pay really, really close attention to, you know, every single lyric on the record. Did you find that, did that ever kind of make you a bit self-conscious or make it a little bit harder to write the lyrics when you knew that people were going to really hang on every word?
I think we did a pretty good job of ignoring that fact. And it means that it's true for the music, too. That's,
yeah.
That's a very typical question that you get asked when you put out a second album.
Thanks.
By journalists, did you feel a lot of pressure for your second album, especially by Dutch journalists? And then the answer, and of course you feel a little more pressure. You know that people are waiting for it. When we made our first album, we wrote those songs. You know, the only people who came to our shows were our friends. But because of the way that we've always operated, you know, having the producer in the band, being kind of this tight-knit, enclosed circle, it felt, when we started working on this record, it really felt like very little had changed. Mm-hmm. So we were able kind of to keep essentially the same process. And also, I think I realized at a certain point that some people are going to get exactly what the songs are about. Some people are going to still like the lyrics, even though they have a different interpretation than me. Some people are going to hate it. And when you take all of that information, it doesn't give you any better idea of how to write songs or write lyrics.
Right.
You know, I mean, obviously, like, you Google anything, you'll get the entire range of human opinion from the, you know, horribly, provocatively negative to the, you know, insanely positive. And what can you possibly do with all of that? You know?
Right.
It's not giving you any clear-cut advice.
Yeah. Does anyone know how long we've been talking for?
We have two microphones.
This gentleman might know in the window.
What do the lyrics, "The kids don't stand a chance," mean? And to the extent there's a bigger story in the song, what is that?
Okay, well, those are the most difficult questions to answer. What does the song mean? Well, I guess I feel comfortable talking about what that song means because a lot of people have, I think, accurately identified some of those themes. And I think when I was graduating from college, I was very stressed out about what I wanted to do. because I certainly wasn't a professional musician, and the idea of becoming a professional musician seemed totally impossible to me. Eventually, I decided to do Teach for America and be a teacher. But at the time, I had a lot of friends who were going to finance and stuff, and part of me wanted to be, looked down on that and feel like, you know, like that's like total bullshit, and that, you know, you have to be like a parasite to want to, you know, go work at an investment bank. But I had to be honest with myself. There was a part of me that was also jealous of the idea that somebody would immediately be making real money out of college and get to choose whatever neighborhood they wanted to live in and get to, you know, eat sushi multiple times a week. And I had to be honest about that fact. And I feel like I grew up with, you know, like we said before, my mom kept her maiden name. You know, she's a real 60s feminist type, and my dad is a 60s type too, and they're very liberal people. And I always felt like I wanted to make sure that, despite the fact that I believed in those ideals, I never would look down too easily on people. Because certainly, not my parents, but I know plenty of people in my extended family who kind of grew up like, you know, hard scrabble in Brooklyn and then worked at Citibank or something. And it's really a real question. What do you make of people like that, you know? And I started to think at a certain level, with all of the shit that gets thrown at you, all of the fear that gets put into you of squandering an expensive education, especially an education that you personally perhaps may be paying for out of pocket month to month for the next 10 to 15 years, it really, there's so much coming at you that it becomes really hard to judge somebody who makes a decision to make real money. And I had to be honest with myself. As much as I wanted to look down on those people, I did kind of feel like there's not a lot of choice in the matter. I don't think that song maybe offers like a clear-cut view of it, but I was thinking about my peers who were going on to make a lot more money than me and who were going on into like very solid career paths, and I was kind of questioning myself about, you know, how do I judge these people? And ultimately what I came up with was that it was hard for me to judge them. And I did kind of feel like there's an element that there's not a lot of choice in the matter, that there's no, you don't have a chance. You're put on that track, you're put into debt, and, you know, like, yeah, why would you say no to those things? So obviously, if you can tell by the way I'm talking about it, it's something that I still think about, and I don't think I totally figured it out. But that's kind of like how that was the genesis of that song.
I think it's
song.
Safe to say that answers your question. Though.
Yeah, but I think that answers the question.
There aren't that many songs I don't think that one could actually give such a clear-cut, articulate answer to, right? I mean, most songs are
maybe
bit more impressionistic
a lot of guys.
Than that.
Yeah, no. You're right, especially our songs. And there probably are even lines in that song that aren't even about that.
Right.
But that's the general thrust, I would say.
I have a question. First of all, you talked a lot about the vibe that drives your music. I'd like to mm-hmm. hear a little bit more about that. And second, a more technical question is about where, do the lyrics drive the music or vice versa?
Oh, well, it would really depend on the song. There, especially for the last album that we made, Contra, I kept a Word file on my computer where I would sometimes just write down lines and images. And that was good to have something to pull from. In the same way that on the first album we had this collection of stories to pull from. But there's certainly songs that, Vampire Weekend songs, where the music was almost entirely completed and then we wrote the lyrics. So it goes back and forth. We try to keep it somewhat unified. And in terms of vibe, I think vibe is just something that is it's hard to put your finger on, but it's when you get a certain group of references that go on to form something kind of intangible. You know, a vibe is something that you can't fully define, but you can link back to specific things. So, you know, an album, you have certain musical references, certain lyrical references, certain visual references, and the vibe is this is greater than the sum of those parts. All those things come together to create that vibe, which, and it kind of makes sense that vibe is a hard word to define. You know, if you know what I'm saying.
It's short for vibration. If that's
it's short for vibration.
Question over here. I wanted to pick up a point that John made about sort of place and where that kind of factors in. I think when I heard Contra, I happened to be in L.A. drinking an horchata and espresso, so maybe that's why it really did feel very California to me. But inherently, there's such a New York kind of thing in your background. I'm wondering, I mean, I'm not getting subways and sort of the feeling of the city in it, so I'm wondering if you, because that's such a big piece of part of narrative, like it's a very easy thing to kind of grab onto in terms of the literary value. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think for now, you know, everybody in the band lives in New York. We've all lived here since we were 18. So this is always going to be kind of our, I don't know, where we're centered. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in California, you know, north and south in the past few years. And it's a place that I felt like I got really excited about. And one of the places that I visited that I really thought about a lot. But, of course, it's still always going to be from a different perspective. And, you know, then it gets into the whole thing of, like, do we have a New York perspective? I guess we have our own specific perspective that's informed by the place that we live, but I think even for us to make an album that we wanted to kind of reflect in, you know, California and our experience in California, for us still, it's going to be kind of rooted in New York, and I think there's, you know, probably just as many references to the city as there are to Los Angeles. So it's always kind of relative how much each album is about a any one place.
You guys haven't talked about it yet, but you know, obviously there are a lot of influences, like, you know, world sort of music influences, or African music or Caribbean music influences. And I guess I'm curious about, first of all, sort of how that started to become part of your music. And then if there was, you know, I guess there's a lot of debate about appropriating sounds or rhythms. I guess what I want to know is if there was ever anything awkward about that for you guys, or if you have sort of discussions within the band where you think, like, about the political, you know, kind of fallout of that process of you know, being influenced by or taking sounds from African musicians or from that tradition. I'm just curious about, like, how you think, you know, what your thoughts are about that.
Sure. I think that we were always kind of aware of how ways in which that might be controversial, but I think for all of us, you know, if you looked at our parents' record collection, there's going to be the Beatles and British music and the Rolling Stones and American music and the blues, and then, you know, at least in the case of my parents, like plenty of reggae and African music and Indian music, and it always kind of seemed to me that that's the way that most people grew up, was listening to a variety of musics, and especially, and this is something that's always been very kind of difficult to talk about because race means, you know, different things to different people, but, you know, within our band, our backgrounds include, you know, Eastern European Jewish and Persian and Italian and Ukrainian, and the idea that somehow all of that would be distilled into this, into like the broad category of white doesn't really make sense to me, you know? I mean, of course, I identify as white, and I wrote on my college application and my SATs and all that. But what does that mean? Is there some sort of, like, specifically white music that a group of people from those backgrounds should be making? Because when you kind of look at the flip side of avoiding being interested in Caribbean music, African music, to me, the opposite of that is, like, some sort of, like, white supremacist, like, Wagner techno. You know, something like really weird.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Of course not. That's something that I've said in a lot of interviews, is the only genre of music I don't like is white supremacist techno. But you really do have to flip it on its head. And I mean, I think what's kind of goofy about it is that when you really look at all of these different types of music and you meet musicians from other parts of the world, which, you know, in our capacity as professional musicians, we've been lucky enough to do, everybody kind of feels the same way who's a musician. The African music that we were inspired by is predominantly, you know, played on the electric guitar, which, you know, technically is an American instrument. I mean, I was born in America. I don't think there's ever been, like, a wave of outrage at the appropriation of the electric guitar by people from other parts of the world. And, of course, whenever you get into stuff like that, it's important to be respectful. But I think beyond that, it's kind of important that everybody kind of shares in it together. And I remember, you know, like I said, like my dad was like a huge reggae dude, and him being like a Jewish kid from the Bronx, he was extremely excited by the melodeon song, The Rivers of Babylon, which is on the Harder They Come soundtrack. and some people might know the Sublime cover of. But he
that really upset me when Sublime covered that. Actually,
it upset you.
They, you know, just the appropriation of that.
Well, see, I'm really interested in the appropriation of reggae by people from California.
Yeah,
I love it. But you know, he was very excited in that, you know, these are verses from the Old Testament, and he told me like this song is about this song is rooted in the experience of the ancient Israelites, you know, which, you know, then you could also ask like what does that have to do with me growing up in New Jersey? But there's something there. It's a very interesting to look at kind of the cross-cultural stuff that's going on in music that people claim is some sort of monolithic thing. So like, is that just Jamaican music? Is that just black Jamaican music? Or is there some sort of Rastafarian, Ethiopian, Judeo connection going on? And I mean, like, you know, you could look at it from a million different angles, but I think it's important to kind of be open-minded in how you look at music. Ultimately, the point is, I don't think Vampire Weekend is unique at all in being interested in more than one type of, you know, ethnically defined music. I think that's how all good music is made. So.
Okay. That's sort of a good way to end it, I guess.
And that's a good way to end it.
Like the last thing.
I think we had a good talk.
We laughed, we cried.
Yeah.
Ezra, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. Good talking to you. Thank you, John.